WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but
we have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Yes, it is Monday, and it is time for Monday Night Talk. Thank you for keeping that radio dial set right there to 95.9 WATD. And to reward you, we have a great show lined up for you. We will start things off first, after traffic, of course. We will speak with Tom Calter. Now, Tom Calter, if you pay attention to the conversations that happen here on the station, if you listen to our news on a regular basis, you'll know that Tom Calter, who served, I think he served like six terms as the state representative for the 12th Plymouth District. Well, he was recently selected to become the town administrator in Kingston and has since stepped away from his duties at the State House, now concentrating just on one community. We're going to have a chance to speak with Tom, kind of get his thoughts. You know, we'll look back and some of the things that he enjoyed as a legislator on the state level, and get his take on the new position. That'll be fun. Then that'll be followed by talking with Simone Winston. Simone is with Winston Flowers, Boston. They have locations in Boston, and we're going to talk a little bit about the organization and how it is. It has a charitable wing, and how it actually gives back to a lot of local organizations that you'll hear the names and go, oh, yes, I know. So we're going to talk with Simone about that as well. The second hour, hour number two of Monday Night Talk, fantastic. It's a little bit of a best of, but I do this because I try to make sure we mix it up. If anything, I would hope that the show isn't tired and boring. And if sometimes we do re-air stuff, it's just because I see it as an opportunity for an audience to have a second listen to something. Maybe they had to get out of the car at one particular point in time and weren't able to check out the podcast. Who knows? But the opportunity is, of course, for the authors who joined us at those particular times. So hour number two is specifically geared towards authors. We'll start at 7 o'clock with Erin Maha Els, and we'll talk about her book, The Crazy Bee. You'll hear that discussion. And then we will chat with legendary author Dean Koontz, talk about his book, The Silent Corner. Fantastic stuff. So we hope you stay right there and you do not go anywhere. And just a quick note, if in fact there are segments or you have questions or even ideas for future topics, conversations, guests, mondaynighttalk@gmail.com. There's also a social media page, Monday Night Talk on 959WATD. It's something like that. You just Google Monday Night Talk and 959, and it should pop up. And if you want to kind of reach out and follow me, I'm on Twitter, Kevin Tachi, T-O-C-C-I. It's pretty much that easy for you to be able to reach out, get involved with the show. Give us an idea, the pulse of the show, what you think, good or bad, it doesn't matter. The ideas for this program to continuously get better and to better inform and entertain and enlighten you, the listener at home. That's what I do this for, is to hopefully better entertain you. So now, without any further ado, I turn it back over. I'll actually turn it over to Ben in the booth as we will cruise into the WATD Traffic Center. Ben?
Thank you, Kevin. This traffic update brought to you by Brennan Smoke Shop, online at BrennanSmokeShopMA.com, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, and now in Pope's Island, New Bedford. Here's George with the WATD Traffic. George?
Well, we're seeing a lot of heavy volume leaving the city. Southbound delays begin up on the Zakin Bridge right through the O'Neill Tunnel down past South Bay. Brakes free for a little bit. Then you'll hit the brakes again from Granite Avenue down to the Braintree Split. Northbound, you're on the brakes from Mass Ave right back up into the tunnel. Route 3 southbound slows coming off the expressway down past Union Street. Then it brakes free the rest of the way. Route 24 slows southbound through Randolph. If you're heading down to the Cape, we're not seeing any issues getting over the Bourne or Sagamore Bridges. Questions about youth or high school sports? Well, Positive Coaching Alliance could help. PCA is a national nonprofit organization developing better athletes and better people through youth and high school sports. Find out more at positivecoach.org. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm George Brown in the WATD Traffic Center.
Memorial Day. It's a day we go to our numerous memorials throughout this great country of ours and remember the ultimate sacrifices made. Our brave men and women have given countless lives and countless limbs so that we can enjoy our many comforts here in America. Lives and limbs were given for you, me, and everyone that calls this land home. These memorials stand year-round as constant reminders, but on Memorial Day, we beautify and remember them with flags, flowers, and families. American families that will always honor their loved ones by living their lives freely. Americans, do not give one inch of your rights, freedoms, and liberties. As the saying goes, if you give them an inch, they will take a mile. If we give up anything, we dishonor the ultimate sacrifices made on our behalf. As Americans, we should expect more freedom, never anything less than we already have. Happy Memorial Day from everyone at Brennan's Smoke Shop.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, thank you for staying with us for this portion of Monday Night Talk. Usually the first segment of the radio program, we usually try to have some kind of a local legislator, somebody who we've had on from time to time, and it doesn't necessarily have to be on the state level. It also can be folks from in and around the South Shore, whether it's a selectman, maybe it's a school committee member, even somebody who might be a town administrator. Today's kind of a something similar to that, as we have the privilege to speak with a gentleman who has served his time up at the State House, the 12th Plymouth District, I believe. State Representative Tom Coulter is our guest, and he is now changing his title to the town administrator for the town of Kingston. Tom, welcome back to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I got to say first, congratulations on the new position.
Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. These are long days, but I think I'm back in my element. What I've been trained to do and what I enjoy doing, and I'm a mile from my five grandsons, so all's good in Coulter world.
I have to ask, what was it like considering the position and knowing the impact that you have made while serving up at the State House and serving your district?
Well, that's a great question, Kevin. I love being a state rep. It was 12 great years. As you know, I come from a family of Army officers, Army chaplains who served gallantly in the 82nd and the 101st Airborne. So serving is in my DNA. And so the last 12 years have been a wonderful privilege for me, a great honor and a wonderful privilege. And I had to think very deeply about leaving the legislature because I have enjoyed it so much. But, you know, at some point in time, I spent 30 years in business traveling around the country, and I spent 12 years in the legislature running around six towns every single day, every single night. So when the opportunity arose in my hometown to serve as the town administrator, it was something I couldn't pass up. For me, it's like coming home.
Talk to me about 12 years. I'm sure that there have been several, many, many milestones, many, many memories that you have forged. Talk to me about some of the ones that still stay with you, resonate with you to this day, that you'll never forget.
There are some that will always resonate with me. And the first one is the very emotional vote we all took on marriage equality 8 or 9 years ago. That was a very divisive issue, as you know. There were some that felt if we voted for marriage equality, the world would come to an end and the Catholic Church would disown me. There are others who felt that it's consistent with our Constitution, the Massachusetts Constitution, Section 2, the Declaration of Rights. So it was an issue that I prayed on, that I thought deeply about, and when I took that vote in support of marriage equality, I knew at that time that would be a monumental moment in my life, and it ended up being exactly that, a monumental moment in my life. But just as importantly, as I said in my farewell speech to my colleagues, you know, there are all types of reps. There are some that are great legislators, and they enjoy the complex public policy matters. There are others that are wonderful orators. They love getting up in a rostrum and speaking, and they're good at it, and they're inspiring. And then there are others that, you know, do a little of each, but mostly focus on constituent service. And for me, constituent service is what being a state rep was all about. I could give you a dozen stories without names of opportunities I had to transform people's lives, whether it was a young person getting into college and figuring out how to pay for it, or an older person getting a decal for a handicap zone, or someone who just refinanced their house to come up with $100,000 for their child's health care because the insurance company wouldn't cover it, only to force the insurance company to cover it. So there are incidents, there are stories like that that will remain, you know, in my mind and until the day I die, that were the best part of my 12 years in the legislature.
The South Shore is not losing not only you, and I shouldn't say losing. Losing is kind of a strong statement, but when we talk about representation up at the State House, there was a symbiotic relationship between all of the representatives, the senators, the legislative delegation down here in the South Shore that could be a model for the folks down in the nation's capital when it comes to trying to get things done. Whether you have a D or an R or an I next to your name, it doesn't matter. Talk to me about someone like a Jim Cantwell, who also is going into another career, or, you know, stepping away from the legislature, but going on to a higher calling.
Well, first and foremost, Jim Cantwell moving on, pardon me, Jim Cantwell moving on leaves unfillable shoes. Jimmy was one of the hardest working legislators on Beacon Hill, and a man of tremendous integrity, a man who works so hard. Jim will be a friend forever because of who he is and how he conducts himself. But, you know, be comforted in knowing that, you know, people like Senate President Murray, people like Senator DiMaceo, people like Tom O'Brien, you know, they set the stage many years ago for acceptable conduct in the South Shore delegation. And there are great leaders, people like Josh Cutler and Matt Muratori, and Vinny is still around, of course, and doing an extraordinary job. People like Bruce Ayers, who have stepped right in and are taking a strong, strong leadership role. Those people have been around for a while. They buy into the bipartisanship. Matt Muratori, a great Republican, Vinny DiMaceo, a great Republican, have worked across the aisle for years, and they'll continue to work across the aisle, and that's why we get things done. But, you know, keep in mind, those people that I just mentioned, I think would concur with me that there are some people that are great legislators, some people that are great orators. Those individuals are very much committed to serving their district. And so it doesn't matter whether you're a D or an R. If you've got Mrs. Jones down the corner that's in trouble in Plymouth, it doesn't matter to Vinny or Matt or myself or Josh or anyone else what their politics are. If they live in the South Shore, if they live in our districts, we all circle the wagons to make sure that we can help address their issues.
I think it's
and that legacy will continue, Kevin.
Right, yeah, you're not going any, but it's just that you're serving the community in a different capacity, so to speak.
Well said. And, you know, I'm not going anywhere. You know where to find me now. And I'll be here. I'll be here every day, all day, and sometimes all night, loving what I'm doing and enjoying the people I'm working with.
And just kind of staying on the thing of working together, I will tell you probably 2 years ago when it was the election cycle, there are memorable spots, commercial spots that we do here in the station. One of them that comes to mind is the Marshfield Hill General Store. But another one, a political one, the one that was done by the law firm, and I get it right, sometimes I don't, usually Jim or Josh will correct me, but the law firm of Cutler, Cantwell, and Coulter, the fun commercial you guys did as to, you know, how you guys work in harmony with one another to get things done.
Well, there's actually a funny backstory to that. I mean, the three of us was at the height of the campaign, and the three of us were very, very tired and not really in a mood to go to WATD and cut a one-minute spoof. But Josh, as he always does, did all the work, and he wrote it, and he edited it, and he prepared it. And the whole spoof was about whose name should go first,
right?
Coulter, Cantwell, or Cutler.
Right.
The backstory is that we didn't know that somebody from Josh's staff was videoing us. And, of course, we're all in jeans or shorts. Now, none of us had shaved that morning. It was a, you know, Friday morning, and we didn't know we were on video. So after we cut the take and read it the way Josh wrote it, and it was very funny. It was something that was so different than all the political ads of attacking each other. It was about unity, and it was funny. And we were arguing whose name should be first on the billboard of the law firm. Well, when it was all over, not knowing we were on tape, Josh spoke to our producer and said, "Hey, are we under a minute?" And I said, "Hey, if we're not, just cut out Cantwell. We'll be just fine." and that is on YouTube right now, and it's got thousands of hits. And I think people just enjoy listening to public officials being human and being funny. But with those guys and with County Treasurer Tom O'Brien, it's funny. We all go to dinner all the time together, and we enjoy each other's company. And occasionally, Vinny or Matt will join us. And, you know, we debate issues, and whoever loses the debate picks up the tab. And that's usually, of course, the Republicans. So we have a lot of fun together.
Well, let's not forget, I believe that there was a time where you were on a ballot, not only as a Dem, but also as a GOP. Am I correct here?
Well, you're 100% correct. It was several elections ago, and I did that for one reason. The people on the other side, my opponents, were behaving badly. And they were flying in the face of everything I believed in about public service. And they were playing the partisan card, and they were being nasty. And so I spoke to both of them, and I told them, I said, "Guys, your brand of politics is not what the 12th District wants or needs or is accustomed to. They deserve much better than that." And, of course, they chastised me for lecturing them. And I said, "Look, I'll give you a couple days to clean up your act. If not, I'm going to run against you in your own primary, in your Republican primary." Well, the behavior continued. So, you know, I have a lot of support from the Republican Party. I'm a very moderate Democrat. And so I called every Republican I knew, and I asked them to write me in, and they did. So I ended up winning the Republican nomination for state rep and the Democrat nomination for state rep. So on the ballot, it said Tom Coulter Republican and Tom Coulter Democrat. It was a lot of fun, and I think it proved that people are thirsting for positive, data-driven discussion and not the type of nasty, vitriol, attacking that seems to have become commonplace. And I was just so proud that night, not for me. I was proud that the people in the 12th Plymouth District demonstrated that they know the difference and that they will not tolerate that type of behavior.
Okay, we're speaking with Tom Coulter, who has stepped down from being, he's leaving the office as a state representative, taking on a new mantle as he's becoming the town administrator in Kingston. If you could, Tom, kind of talk to us about that new role and how you're embracing it.
Well, it's a ton of fun right now. I officially started Monday morning, the 14th, But I actually came to town hall over 3 weeks ago and have been working every day as a volunteer to learn the job, to understand the issues, to understand the opportunities. Kingston is a wonderful town. It's got wonderful people running this town. And we have a very strong financial position, very strong balance sheet, healthy reserves, great bond rating. But now this is our opportunity to reach out and grow our commercial industrial base to try and take some of the pressure off our residents who are paying very high residential property taxes. So my primary challenge and my primary focus is to build a clean industrial base that serves our community's tax base so we can continue to have a high quality government, quality services, very high quality buildings. I'm talking to you today right now from my office at Town Hall, and as I look around, I mean, this place is 14 years old and it's beautiful, and it's a very prideful place, and people keep it that way, and I think it's a reflection of how people feel about their town. So for me, it's just a tremendous privilege and a great honor to be here and to be the leader of this team and to serve a board of selectmen who I've always had great respect for and I enjoy working with. So again, as I said to you earlier, Kevin, I'm 1 mile from my five grandsons who at this stage of their life wouldn't enjoy being 1 mile from the five most important people in my world.
I would ask you, you know, going from being a state representative and sitting down and having a $38, $39, $40 billion budget to where now you're sitting down and I don't know exactly how many millions Kingston's budget is, whether it's $30, $40, $50 million. Talk to me about having the knowledge and the understanding as to what happens of the process up at the State House and how that helps you in your job be able to help, you know, put together the next fiscal year budget and also be able to lobby for extra money if needed for Chapter 70 money or Chapter 90 money and stuff like that.
Sure. Well, the combination of 30 years as a senior executive or business owner in the private sector combined with 12 years in the legislature has given me a very, very unique perspective. And another wonderful advantage is when you serve in the legislature, you build a network of relationships, whether it be the governor, the lieutenant governor, the cabinet secretariats, the people throughout the bureaucratic across other bureaucracy. And you know, every town has significant needs, whether it's seawall, whether it's infrastructure investment, whether it's Mass Works grants or environmental grants. So knowing who to call and getting a phone call back and having a prior relationship is a huge advantage in managing a town. Having 30 years of business experience and the budgeting process, but most important, this is all about people. Knowing how to work with, how to coach, how to inspire, how to lead people is key because no one in any organization is strong enough, tough enough, powerful enough to get it done all by themselves. You have to be in an organization where everyone is empowered to do their job and inspired to want to do it well. And I think, humbly stated, that is what I bring to this organization. There are a lot of great employees in this town who are just thirsting for strong, enthusiastic, informed leadership so that they can be the best that they can be. And when it comes together, it's a beautiful thing to experience. It really is.
I guess I would ask you is, and I don't know if it's something that was part of the conversation you had with the Board of Selectmen or something that you've already kind of done as a mechanism and an internal mechanism. Have you kind of set goals for yourself for the next year or during your career, your new career as the town admin?
Well, as you know, I'm a long-term goal setter. I believe that successful people set measurable objectives over definite timelines. And at the end of those timelines, they look back and they evaluate whether they achieved them or they didn't. They're either shakers or they're fakers. So, you know, before I took this job, I set clear objectives for the first year, for the first 3 years. And everything I do will be geared towards achieving those objectives. You know, I know the old saying, make America great again, has worn thin with people, but Kingston is already a great community. And my goals, my objectives that I've set, is to refine every system, every position in this town so that the people of Kingston are proud of this town. And that's my most important priority, is that the people we work for look at this town hall and they say, we're proud of our government. And if we can accomplish that, whether it be snow removal, whether it be filling potholes, whether it be serving their needs, whether it be open transparency on every dollar we spend, my goal is to go to town meeting one day, which right now is struggling. Town meeting, we're going on our third night and probably into our fourth night, is to go to town meeting and have the folks in Kingston look at their government and say, we know these people, we like these people, we understand the issues because they've informed us of the issues, we trust their judgment, and we're going to let them run this town. That's not something you can command, it's not something you can demand, it's something you earn. And that's my most important objective over this first year, is to earn the respect and the trust of the people that pay us and to the of the people that we serve.
Yeah, you know, we're at that interesting time of year. You talk about town meeting, but it's also that time of year where if you're running for office, if you're seeking re-election, you get your paperwork, in. If you're incumbent, you're out there, you're kind of letting folks know, hey, I'm here, and you start, you know, the process of getting mobilizing your campaign for re-election. You don't have to worry about that. Give me your thoughts about, you know, the process of getting ready for re-election, and that's something that, well, maybe you might miss that.
Well, it's interesting you say that. This was the first year out of six terms, out of 12 years, that I didn't have an opponent. This would have been my first re-election where I didn't have to knock on doors all summer. And so, you know, the timing was very unusual. But there are some great candidates that are now, since I'm out, are running for this seat. You know, right here in Kingston, Kathy Lenatra, who's a member of the Kingston Board of Selectmen, has announced her candidacy. And, you know, I've always respected and admired Kathy from afar. And I think that, you know, the team that helped put me in the State House has circled the wagons around Kathy and her candidacy. So I think that she's now working very hard, already going door to door. So I'm very comfortable that the work that has been going on for more than 20 years for the 12th District, starting with Representative O'Brien, his 10 years, my 12 years, that will be continued with the next state representative. So it is bittersweet, more sweet than bitter. And I'll feel very, very, very happy when November comes and goes, and I know there's a person in that seat that will continue to provide the level of constituent service to the 12th that the district has come to expect and deserves.
I guess I would ask you is other than the seat that you previously occupied, like a Jim Cantwell, you know, there are going to be a number of suitors who are going to look to capture the vote and be able to best represent that district. Are there races like your former seat or Jim's or others that you're going to be watching now that you can kind of sit back and be more of a spectator than somebody who's kind of in the ring?
Absolutely. But, you know, anyone who runs for Jim Cantwell's seat and for the seat vacant in the 12th Plymouth District would be wise to look at how Jim Cantwell served. And Jim Cantwell was extraordinarily successful, not only in getting reelected handily, but in terms of his relationship with his constituents. So any candidate would be wise to look at what worked for Jim. How did he conduct himself? Who did he work with? What were his public policy positions? And if they want to be successful, then they should try to model that man, because it's up to the state rep not to bring to the district his or her ideological values, but to understand the pulse, the value, the values, and the important issues for that district. you know, Jim clearly, Josh Cutler is especially good at this. Well, they all are, Vinny and Matt. They listen to their district, and they formulate their service plan. They formulate their legislative agenda based upon the will of the people they serve. It's the politicians with a deaf ear that want to come to office with a simple solution for a complex problem, who want to come to office by demeaning the person they run against, that always come in second or third or fifth. People need energy. They need hope. They need optimism. They need vision. They need honesty and transparency. People like Cutler and Cantwell and O'Brien and DiMacedo and Bruce Ayers, all those folks, they get it. Jamie Murphy, they all get it. They know that they're servants of the public. The public doesn't serve them. They serve the public. So anybody that's going to run for the 12th Plymouth District seat or Jim Cantwell seat should understand that, because the mold has been cast. They're not going to change the mold. And if they start tearing down their opponents, or if they start coming up with simple solutions to very complex problems, the people in those districts know when they come up with a simple solution to a complex problem, it simply means they don't understand the problem. Mm. And so it's the bar has been set, and whoever wins those seats have to understand that the bar has been set, and they would be wise to listen to the gentleman whose names I've mentioned earlier as a guide to how to serve their districts.
Some excellent advice given by you, Tom, in regards to if you are a candidate, you are somebody who's getting out there, probably the key to not becoming a perennial candidate is being somebody who, you know, run on your own merit and what you have accomplished as an individual, and not so much from attacking another individual for where maybe they've had shortcomings or, you know, or what's been perceived as not necessarily a success, so to speak.
Well, you know, Kevin, it's the world, I think, as dark as it may seem at times, is changing for the better. I teach classes at Quincy College, or did until this job, and I taught classes at the Senior Center in Duxbury. And they used to say to me, they said, with all this technology, we have so much information, and Fox tells us one thing, CNN tells us another. You know, there's not enough hours in the day to study the issues. Mm-hmm. And so I gave them little keys, little cues. And I said to them, you know, you may not understand all of the issues all of the time, but what you should do is when there's an important issue of the day, listen to both stations, and then do the research on who told you the truth.
Right.
That's the first thing, or the commentator that told you the truth. But the most important thing when you're evaluating candidates is if a candidate, again, comes up with a simple solution to a very complex problem, it means they don't know the full extent of the problem. And if a candidate demeans his or her opponent in order to elevate themselves, it means they lack the character. It means they lack the demeanor to serve in public office. People demand, they expect, they deserve more from the people they elect to office. And I would tell you the South Shore delegation, they're all ladies and gentlemen. Joe Moschino down in Hull, perfect lady, wonderful human being. They all are very sociable. They're all very kind. And they're all well-behaved, but most importantly, they're all well-informed. The South Shore delegation, when a member of our team gets up and debates, they know their stuff. They have the data. And people in our districts have come to expect data-driven answers, data-driven discussion, not a bunch of political rhetoric. And that's why the delegation works well together. We all believe, Democrat and Republican, that if reasonable people all look at the same accurate data, then their positions will not vary very much. Their ideology does not drive decisions. Data drives decisions.
And I might add is all the individuals that Tom has mentioned are regular guests on this program. Come on this, there's usually never any hesitation, including Tom, to come on the program, talk about what's going on, share the latest information that they're working on, whether it's up at the State House, whether it's, you know, something in their district. And that's kind of the beauty of what we have going on with the South Shore delegation, no matter what, you know, no matter what party they are affiliated with. Tom, we're short on time here, but is there anything you want to say in closing in regards to our conversation here today?
I do, Kevin, and thank you for that opportunity. I want to thank WATD. I served for 12 years, and WATD has been very generous, very gracious with the time you've afforded me to express my views, my opinions over the past 12 years. Most importantly, WATD has played a critical role in building a South Shore delegation that behaves a certain way. And so although you seem to marvel the South Shore delegation from afar, you should take some credit for the demeanor and the behavior, because that's become the model, whether it's Christine's debates or your Monday night talk shows. You don't bring on people that demean the process. You're not looking for, you know, shock jock headline news.
Right.
You're looking to dig deep into issues of the day. And I can tell you that I and the members of the South Shore delegation really appreciate the maturity that you bring to this process. And I want to thank you, Ed Perry, Christine, and all of you for what you've done for me, but most importantly, what you've done for the political process.
Well, and don't forget the forum bell as well. That is another tool that we have that will Absolutely. Police folks as well.
Thank you for that. Yes, so true.
Well, listen, I want to thank you, and I want to extend it, even though you are now in a new role. I definitely welcome you to come on at any particular time, whether it's about a local issue or it's something that's up at the State House that, you know what, maybe you have some insight on. Love to have you on, whether you're just as a guest or, hey, if you get some Monday night that, you know, you're tired of playing with numbers, you want to come hang out, you can co-host a couple of segments with me if you like.
Kevin, I'd be honored to do that, and I won't go away. I mean, the Mont Ponsett water and Jones River,
right.
Silver Lake issue is still top of mind. It affects my town, and I'm going to stay all over that. Here I come, Brockton.
Here he is, going from state representative, serving the 12th Plymouth District. Now he is the Kingston Town Administrator. We have Tom Coulter as our guest. We're going to step aside for just a moment, and when we come back, we are going to speak with Simone Winston. You're listening to Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk here on 959WATD. And we have a special guest, as we try to do here on the radio program from time to time. When it comes to charities, when it comes to organizations that give back to the community or give back, I think it's important that we share that information to let folks know that, you know, our corporate partners are part of the community. And joining us today, we have Simone Winston, who is of Winston Flowers. Simone, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I have been married to my husband, Ted, for 26 years,
wow.
And with that came my engagement in Winston's family, Winston Flowers, his family business. He and his brother, David, have been running the business for many years now, and which was started by their family in 1944, and with that came my engagement into the Boston community and many of the nonprofit organizations here in this area, and we have now extended that in 2010 to our Charity in Bloom program.
Yeah, talk to us about Charity in Bloom. When did this organization start, and what is it about? From my understanding, it's kind of a charitable wing of the Winston Flowers.
That's correct. So in 2010, my husband created this program After many years of our being involved in different nonprofits in the area and working with events and galas, and then on a more personal level, having our family involved in some causes that were specific to and near to our hearts. And he created this program as a way for us to become engaged with some nonprofits in the area that we might not have been familiar with, and allowing our customers and our supporters to introduce us to some of those organizations and become more engaged with issues that were important to our customers and the supporters of Winston Flowers.
How did the Perkins School for the Blind become one of the first beneficiaries of Charity in Bloom?
Well, to be quite honest, Perkins School for the Blind became our guinea pig, so to speak, as our very first Charity in Bloom partner. My friend, Corinne Grousbeck, who is the chairman of the board and a parent of a former Perkins student, had brought this up. We had discussed with her about engaging Perkins in another meaningful way, along with our support of the gala every year. And she was very instrumental in allowing us to learn about marketing the Charity in Bloom program and how to reach not only our customers, but the supporters of the organizations that we have partnered with along the way.
And it seems as though that there was some significant success, as the number of organizations besides the Perkins School for the Blind has reached over 40 organizations. Is that true?
That's correct.
Wow.
We have been able to engage with over 40 organizations in the last 8 years through the Charity in Bloom program.
And I believe the amount is over $2 million. Now, how is this achieved? Is there a certain amount of the proceeds that are taken? I don't know how it's done, but if you could kind of explain that, how do you end up, is it specials that are done through Winston Flowers? How do you decide the monies that you're going to give to those organizations?
So the way that the program is set up is that a series of arrangements is created every month that is specific to Charity in Bloom. They come at different price points, and 20% of the sales are then given back to the organization at the end of the month. And customers can call and specifically request the Charity in Bloom arrangement. They can see them online. We obviously, if they call on the phone, describe what the arrangement looks like for that month. And then, as I said, at the end of the month, 20% of the sales from the Charity in Bloom arrangements are given right back to that organization.
Now, we know that you have stores in Boston.
Yeah.
Are there other stores, or are there other nonprofit partners in other parts of the country that you also give money to?
Yes. Yeah, so, obviously, the Charity in Bloom program began in Boston, and since then, and we have stores in the greater Boston area, since then we have opened in Greenwich, Connecticut, and most recently we have opened in New York City, and we have tried to combine the Charity in Bloom program with both the Connecticut and now the New York customer base, and tried to find organizations that had either a partner program in those other cities, or find comparable programs that targeted a similar mission, so that both are Connecticut, or all three are Connecticut, New York, and Boston customers could engage in the Charity in Bloom program and stay within the same organizational type that month.
Okay, we're speaking with Simone Winston, and we're here talking a little bit about not only so much Winston Flowers, but their organization Charity in Bloom, which has been operating since May of 2010, and can boast that it has supported over 40 organizations and donated in excess of $2 million or somewhere in thereabouts. If I could ask you, Simone, what are the types of, what's the criteria for a particular organization where the charity in Bloom says, yes, this is an organization that we are willing to cut a check and assist?
The way that we have set this up, and obviously this was through a little bit of trial and error over the years, is there are definitely some organizations that we have a very close connection to, and so a few of the organizations we have supported for several years. But for the other months of the year, as we choose a different organization for each month of the year, we try to have our customers reach out to us and let us know about some organizations that they find near and dear to them. And organizations can then submit an application to us online through the Charity in Bloom link on the website. And then at the end of the summer, beginning of the fall, we sit down as a group and go through all the applications and decide which organizations we would like to partner with for the following calendar year.
Okay, so let me ask you this, and that is, how has you talk about the Perkins School being kind of the first organization as to the trial and error? What's some of the residuals that you've been able to see them do with the money that makes you smile and makes you guys say, yeah, we've really done something well here, where they've been able to institute this and help those in need, so to speak?
Yes, so with Perkins, which is really around the corner from us here and really very easy for us to see the work that they do there on a daily basis, we have been able to help them with job preparedness for their graduates, for technology challenges that their students and their graduates face, and be able to give the students the technology that they need to succeed, not only while they're in school, but after they leave Perkins and head out into the world. And those have been real implementations with funds that have been raised for the Charity in Bloom program.
Now, is there anything that I haven't asked you during this segment, but it feels kind of important to letting our audience know, other than stopping by one of the locations or visiting the website, www.winstonflowers.com, what would you like to share with our audience?
Well, we would just want to thank your audience and the Boston and Connecticut and New York communities at large for supporting Winston Flowers and supporting the organizations that do so much great work here. And we couldn't do it without any of you, and we really appreciate your time.
Excellent. And I want to thank you so much for joining us and let my audience know that, see, when you are enlisted in an organization or you go to a business like a Winston Flowers and you spend your money, you know that at least there is a side that they are giving back to the community, as is the conversation we just had with Simone. Simone, I want to thank you for being a guest here on Monday Night Talk, and please thank both your husband and his brother Dave for all that they do.
Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing us to your community. We appreciate it.
You got it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Simone Winston has been our guest, talking a little bit about Charity in Bloom and how Winston Flowers, with locations in the Boston area, are involved in giving back. So a fantastic segment, great way to end the first hour. Coming up in just a couple of moments, hour two of Monday Night Talk, as we will have a special Best of Authors Hour, as it'll feature Aaron Maha Ells and legendary author himself, Dean Koontz. That's coming up in just a few moments, right here on Monday Night Talk, only heard here on 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
the South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD-FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.
I'm Bob Smaldone of Budget Blinds, and I hope what happened to me never happens to you. I was driving down Route 3, perfect visibility, and a wild turkey flew right in front of my windshield. Glass in my face, I was startled, and that doesn't even begin to describe the effect. I could have lost control, others could have been hurt. But there was good news. Tiny & Sons replaced my windshield, cleaned up my truck, even gave me some medical attention. Tiny's boys really do a good job.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. And as folks know, from time to time, I think it's becoming more of a regular basis, I like finding the author, the individual who has put their heart and soul into writing. It could be, I mean, we've had a number of folks, local folks here, whether it's Maureen Boyle, who was in through here a few weeks ago with her book about the New Bedford Highway, the serial killer. Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge, they have been regulars on here with whether it was the Boston Strong book or the new book on Pete Frates. And just last week, we had this gentleman named Archer Mayer. You remember. A gentleman who, through his real life, the jobs that he does, decided to write about a detective series. And it's become quite the successful detective series. Well, we hope that the next author that you hear from, which will be in just a moment, is somebody that you'll want to check out their works of art and get to know them a little bit better through this this interview. And joining us right now on the phone line is, now, Aaron, you'll correct me if I say it wrong, or maybe your pops might, Aaron Maher Alves. Is that correct?
Very good.
Okay. And she's here to talk to us a little bit about a book that she has written, her first book, and the book is called The Crazy Bee. And we're going to get a whole rundown on the book and some of the behind-the-scenes things, and maybe even find out if she's working on something else as well. So welcome to Monday Night Talk. Thank you for joining us this evening. And I guess the first thing is by nature, are you somebody who, are you a literary person? Are you somebody who has always aspired to write a book?
I grew up in a time where girls weren't actually told that it was okay to be nerdy. And because I grew up in the 80s, and so for me, I started to escape in books at such a young age because I would get bored with what was going on in my life, and so I would start reading and reading, and then by the time I was in sixth grade, I was pulled aside by an elementary school teacher, and direct quote, "You are a terrible child, but you can write really well." And it was like the first time that somebody had taken me aside and said, "Wow, you do something very well." In my life,
but put it in, put that whole thing, if you could kind of repeat that. They basically said something negative and then paid you a compliment.
Well, because it was when you were behavioral in the 80s, you didn't get cute little words of like, this is why they're behavioral. I was just behavioral because I was bad. Nobody talked to me what was going on with me. Instead, they just used negative terminology.
Yeah, now, if you don't mind me asking, so you did you graduate in the 80s or did you graduate in the 90s?
I graduated in 95, and at that point, I was hearing from I was a graphic design student at Southeastern, and I was still hearing from teachers. I was very talented, but I was still slightly bad, so.
So what do you like to craft? Are you somebody who, you know, that's your regular line of work where you're doing graphic arts and you're creating artistry for other folks on a commercial level?
My favorite type of graphic design is when I'm working with a client and we come up something together so they feel like they're part of it. I've done wedding invitations and I've done shower invitations, and I spent a lot of time in art college, and I used to be a arts and crafts teacher for a long time.
Okay, so give me the concept. What was the epiphany that one day you said, you know, I want to write a book, but you also had the concept as to what the book would be about.
Anger. I got angry in the 90s because I was in the whole behavior stuff. I ended up in a psych hospital by the time I was 15 years old. I got sectioned because I did something that was dangerous to myself. And the next thing you know, my whole life changed, and I'm in a psych hospital, and I realized that I lost all my rights. And you have no rights when you're 15, but I lost all my rights. And it turned into a six-week-long adventure. And when I got out of the psych hospital, I went back to high school, and I pretended nothing happened. I didn't talk to anybody about what was going on. I had to write a story about being oppressed by the government. It was because we were studying science fiction propaganda literature, so we had to write a story about being oppressed, and I wrote a story about being in a psych hospital and accepting oppression. Wow. And my teacher pulled me aside and goes, "That was a beautiful story, but is it true?" And I explained it was, and so she took interest in me and kept on having me read books and books and books, and then had me write about the book so I could really learn how to actually have a style.
And what was the book, what was the series? I'm sure that there's a top three of those books that she had you read that you feel that you've magnificently captured a style or a specific style that was comfortable for you.
It's kind of a little weird because it was Dean Koontz, and he's such a dark writer who creates these worlds of, like, kind of unimaginable pain. So, and she just kept on, like, I can't even remember all the titles because she just kept on feeding them to me, and I was so, like, thirsty to figure out how to write. So we just went through it for a year. And it's not like she told anybody she was doing this or anything. She just did it, you know, because she took interest in me.
Can I tell you something that you have in common with Dean Koontz at the moment?
What?
That both of you have actually appeared on this radio show within the past 6 months.
That's weird.
Yeah, yeah. He's actually promoting a new book. And if you look in the podcast, I think I have every podcast that I've done. Oh, God, dating back for the past 7 years, probably I get over 900 podcasts, and we changed the format as to how we do the podcasts. Instead of doing, like, individual podcasts, now it's more or less it's the whole entire show. And I want to say it was within the past 6 months we had him on, and he was talking about this new book that he had. Now, I don't have the information in front of me, but it's just ironic you bring up Dean Koontz, and he, like you, have appeared on this program and talked about, you know, how you, the process, so to speak.
Very cool.
So kind of give us, now walk us through, you know, where did you start and when it came to saying, okay, I'm going to write a book, and who was the person you had to have a go-to, or a couple of, was it this teacher, or were there other people that you would bounce your ideas off of when you were kind of going along the process?
I started writing in 2009 because I realized my life was going to change in a way that only a mentally ill person is comfortable to have this type of change. So I started writing because I knew it was the only way I was going to have a document of my recovery from mental illness. So I wasn't doing well. I wasn't healthy in about 2010, and I'd bump into she's a woman now, but when I helped raise her, she was a kid I used to babysit. I started babysitting her when I was, I think, like 13, and she was 2. And at this point now, she's maybe in her 20s, and she's an English teacher at a middle school. And she can tell I'm not doing well. And she's like, "What's going on there?" And I go, "I'm trying to write a book, but I don't have anybody to write to." And she goes, "You can start writing to me." And I was like, "You really wouldn't mind that?" And she goes, "No." And I warned her immediately. I go, "The story's very hard to read. It's a dark story. I don't know if you're, like, you know, you want to actually go through that." And she said, "Oh, I can read it. It's just literature." So I start sending her pages, and it was the weirdest thing. I just kept sending her pages and pages, and years are going by, and I just keep sending her stuff, and she's editing it, and she's changing it, and she's questioning, "Is this exactly what you want to say to the reader?" And I'm starting to use tons of different literary styles to get my story across because it's sad material, but I want it to be a fun book.
How do you put those two contexts in the same sentence? It's almost like it's like me. I like if I eat something, if I eat something sweet, I gotta have something salty. Is that what you're the concept of where it while it may be dark, you want it to be fun?
Well, life is kind of bittersweet. We always have bittersweet moments where you have the best visit with a loved one, but they have to leave. So my story material is sad. I went through a lot of stuff that it was painful. But in the end of the day, I've always chosen to live to live. So I wanted to make sure that the person who's reading the story gets the lesson and the moral of it, but they also kind of enjoy the ride.
So is it almost like an autobiography? Is it almost does it parallel your life, but you make incremental changes, so it can be its own? Kind of give us an idea here.
The publishing company that now it's trendy. When I first started writing this in 2000, like when I first started going through what I was going through, and I was talking about writing the book in 2011, what I was going through, I just was fed so much discrimination. So I had to power through with what I was going through and smile and do all that. But at the same time, now it's trendy. Mental health is finally being spoken about. And so I actually got my story out during Recovery Month and Suicide Prevention Month. So my publishing company was pushing me to get the book out now, because it's so relative to what's going on in society. And they also pushed me to write it as a memoir. And there's a lot of, like, because it's about mental health, there's a lot of playing back and forth with the reality. Am I a real person? Am I not a real person? Is what I'm going through real or not? Because I kind of wanted to make the reader try to figure out if it was real or not.
So not only has this been a passion, but it sounds to me like it was medicinal in some form, too?
Very cathartic. I'm very happy I chose to take bad stuff in my life and turn it into art. I'm very happy with that.
Okay. I don't want to give away the ending. And again, just so folks know, we are speaking with a local author, Erin Maha Elves, and we're talking about her book, The Crazy Bee, and we're kind of going through the steps as to how she decided to write a book and how she got to this point. Now, while you and I were kind of doing the warm-up in the bullpen, to get to know each other a little bit and know where the conversation would go, one of the things that you had shared with me is that there's a controversy to this. Have we told the controversy? Have you shared that? Or is there more to any controversy that is surrounded with the book itself?
The actual controversy is because I was 15 and angry at the mental health system, I was so upset that I had no role models. You have to understand, when you get out of a psych hospital, you can't eat, like back then, because it was the 90s. I couldn't speak about what I had gone through, and I had no role models to sustain normalcy, because my goal when I was growing up was to always sustain a normal life, even though I have mental health issues. So what I ended up doing was kind of a little controversial. I went from having like a psychotic break at 15, 16, to going back to work and choosing my profession to work with children. So I ended up being a teacher for over 20 years. And then when I was outed in court in 2011, that's where the controversy started, because I called my local newspapers to explain, oh, mentally ill mothers can lose custody of their kids if they go into psych hospitals, if they get treatment. And I kept on hearing over and over again, not just from newspapers, from friends and like from people who had known me my whole life, they kept saying, you shouldn't have worked with children, never mind having children, because you're mentally ill, and mentally ill people shouldn't have those things. And I remember smiling with just a crazy smile and going, that's your ignorance, and you don't understand, and that's okay. So I had to keep on smiling through people saying things to me that were insensitive and rude and discriminatory. And I thankfully handled it well, because I have a high tolerance to ignorance.
And so you were able to persevere, and is this stuff that's also in the book as well, as talking about the ignorance and talking about how all these, whether it's folks in the media or just people in general, saying, hey, as someone who has mental health issues, You should not. You have no rights. You shouldn't be able to bear children. You shouldn't even walk across the street. I mean, is that in the book?
Yeah, you actually, you feel like it happens to you, because I write in this way where I speak directly to the reader, because the story is about surviving suicide attempt and moving on in your life and figuring out why you're alive. And because it was the only way that I could communicate to anybody that you have no clue what's going to happen next. And so if you take away your life, you're like, you're shutting it down. You have no chance to have anything change. And so I survived, and everything just kept on slowly, slowly changing. And I document the years that it's passing, that years are going by, and everything is changing in my life, and for the better. And I'm getting healthier and healthier to the point where I'm at now.
Well, you mentioned a couple of things during our conversation here. You talk about, you know, there was a time in the 80s where, you know, it was almost like illegal to be a nerd, or, you know, talking about, you know, having mental health issues and how people, the perception. Do you feel that perceptions have changed in areas like that, or do you feel that they're still evolving and they need to continue evolving?
We're at the point in society that we have to have a change of how we see mental health, because we need to have a conversation, especially with our children, especially with our teenage children, that like, we know you're going through something, that you're going through something that is hard, and the discrimination, the stigma will eventually stop, and it will be a trend eventually that we're going to have healthy conversations about mental health. But what's going on right now is we're about to have a mental health crisis. By 2020, all Americans are supposedly going to have mental illness. The government figured it out in 2010, and they put out a cute little website called Healthy People 2020, which is awesome, but it's not talking about why it's okay to have mental health issues. In other countries right now, they're aware that we're having a mental health crisis in 2020, and they're already starting the conversation in a positive manner. Mental health has always been such a stigmatized, taboo subject that we just can't talk about it. We are conditioned not to speak about it. Mm. My book can't change it. My book can't fix it. There's no, like, actual fix to this, but people like me trying to talk about it like it's a normal subject is starting the conversation.
So it sounds to me as though with the title of the book, now, were you able to choose the title of the book, or was that through the publisher?
I got to choose the title. The actual story behind it is, I'm a crazy, you know, inappropriate word. Because when I was going through my divorce proceedings with my ex-husband, I walked over to him, and it was 2009, and I look at him, and I go, okay, I understand that you can take me to court and get the kids away from me, because I'm not even supposed to have children, ha-ha. And I looked at him, and I said, are you going to take me to court? And he goes, oh, I would never take you to court. I'm like, yeah, okay, I believe you. And then that was the year I started writing the book, because I knew that I was going to have to go to court, because I was going to get treatment for my mental health, and he was going to use it against me. So it's almost like a joke, like, you know, don't push a really nice person to get so angry that they have to document their recovery in a book, because I have two daughters now, and it's cute now if my kids say, oh, my mom wrote the crazy bee, but it would have never been appropriate for them to say the negative word.
What was it like to finally see the finished product? I mean, what was it like to get it over the finish line where you got it all together front to back, and then, you know, they put together the concept art to have the book completed and show you?
The company I went with, we went step by step together, which was awesome, because I have the background in graphic design, so I really got to put my input in. But by the time that I got it home, like, and it was in the mail, and I'm sitting outside, and I'm doing a video, and I share it with my Facebook friends, because they've been following me for years writing this book. It was like a complete dream come true, because to think in your head when you're a 15-year-old kid, I want to write this story, and it's going to help the next generation, it's going to help everybody, to actually have it in your hand and just be able to be proud of yourself, because it was something I worked for.
If I could transport you back to being that 15-year-old kid that was on the cusp of taking, from what I'm understanding here, you're on the cusp of taking your own life. Is that correct?
Yes, I would go back and forth with being suicidal when I was growing up.
But isn't that, aren't we seeing these days when it comes to the teen suicide rate that it's pretty high, and it's something that is, it's not just something that Erin is afflicted with, but that our teens are afflicted with?
The rate of the suicide right now is that 90% of people with known mental illnesses are committing suicide. And it's affecting the younger generation because they weren't taught to how to communicate their feelings. I grew up silently suffering without speaking to my mother or my father because I didn't know how to be like, well, this is how I cope. I don't know how you guys cope, but I'm coping by being suicidal. It's teaching children to actually communicate with their parents the truth, the honest truth that, I'm not perfect, I'm suffering, and I need help.
What was it like when, as far as getting the first books out there, what have you heard from folks who have sat down, who have read it, whether it's constructive criticism or accolades?
The hardest part was somebody who was young read my book, and she got herself into a situation where she had to be admitted into a psych hospital because after she read my book, she realized how suicidal she was, and she didn't want to live like that anymore. So she was admitted into a psych hospital, and now it's a year later, and she's in college. She has a full-time job, and she's engaged to be married and moving out with her boyfriend very soon and healthy. But that was one of the hardest things to deal with because I didn't think that could happen.
Okay. Any thoughts as to where do you go from here other than promoting this book? Do you get any fresh ideas for maybe another book? Because myself, I find it an interesting concept when someone is able to write a book and then before you know it, it's almost like the bug hits you. Hey, wow, that was a journey to be able to, from start to finish, and then be able to put it out there and have other people read it and give me their feedback. It's almost like a drug.
Well, my next book is called Resilient, and it's going to be a story of not only my stories of strength, but friends and family stories of strength where you learn how to push through the pain no matter how hard it is.
Now, is this strictly just from folks that you know who are going through tough times, but yet have shown that resilience, and mm-hmm. and any thought of maybe getting a clinician in to somehow be a part of it, or is it strictly just stories of folks who have persevered?
My writing style is so anti-clinician because I hate the way the mental health field is treated in America. Because at this point, my therapist took away all my diagnoses after he read the book. He literally read the book, and he took it as a nice, kind way of me saying the mental health system can now just go to heck, and I don't want to deal with you guys ever again.
Right.
And so he was so happy to finish the book, and he was just like, okay, you don't have to come to therapy anymore. You're all set. Good. It was really nice treating you. And then he started getting sad and goes, can we still see each other? And I said, sure. And he goes, for book two? And I said, sure. So I'm going to continue to stay in therapy, but my point of view will never be the clinical point of view because I'm just a mere person who went through a very hard system that is trying to give guidance to the next generation or even my generation how to survive it.
Where do you feel that mental health, as far as treatment goes, where do you feel that it's going wrong? Do you feel that, from back when you were 15 years old to, seeing somebody who you've had conversations with, where is it going wrong, and where do you feel that it needs to get back on track?
The first thing, when you're being told that you have mental health issues, you have to be told at the same exact moment you are a human being. You have value, you have substance, you have creativeness, you have spirituality, you are more than your mental illness. What's going wrong is that we keep talking about what is wrong with somebody and not what is right. My mantra since I was 15 years old was pretty much screw them. You are more than your mental illness, no matter what I went through. And I'm an overachiever. Like, I excel all the time, and it's never good enough, but I always will just continue to excel. And I graduated from Mass Associated Dean's List student, and I was a student senator, and I volunteered at the Special Olympics. There was so much more to me than just my mental illness. It was just that in my head, because I had gotten sick of thinking, I kept being repetitive with my negative thoughts, and I couldn't speak about that I had negative thoughts because it's not acceptable. We need to make sure that whoever has mental health issues understands that their value is so much more than that.
Any fear, you know, these days, the one thing that is synonymous with mental health and mental health issues, and I hear it repeatedly, is when there's gun violence. What goes through your head when those two are in the same sentence?
A little too late. I always keep, because I track everything, because I want to make sure that I understand what's going on. And so I go, okay, we have another person who obviously is sick, who's obviously not stable. Mm-hmm. There's evil in the world. There's always going to be evil in the world. So when somebody gets to the point that they're about to hurt somebody, they need to be actually capable of saying, I'm sick and I need help. I had a friend recently whose friend had a psychotic break, and he started saying the voices are telling me to hurt others. And thankfully the kid communicated, I'm having trouble, I need help. And he ended up in a hospital for a few weeks, got stabilized, and then was released back to society and is functioning enough that he's not hurting others. We have to make sure that people understand that these thoughts are not normal thoughts. It's not okay to hurt everybody. It's not okay to take your pain out on somebody else. And we also need to teach how to cope with bad things, because we always hear that this one person was triggered, and the next thing you know, they were pushed to hurt other people. The amount of crap that I've gone through in my life, I've always used my spirituality to connect to the fact that people are doing things wrong to me, but it's not because they want to, it's because of their ignorance. Again, we're not even talking about hurting ourselves or hurting others because it's such a taboo subject. Well, it's coming out of being taboo. But we have to have a conversation about it.
We've been speaking with Erin Maha Elves and talking about her new book, The Crazy Bee, and we've plumb out of time, and I want to say it's been a great conversation. I want to thank you for sharing your story, talking about your book. If folks are interested in purchasing your book or getting your book, how can they do that?
It's on Amazon. It's called The Crazy Bee.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you'll stay in touch and let us know how your next project is going and share details of that with our audience here on Monday Night Talk.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You got it. Erin Maha Elves has been our guest for this portion of Monday Night Talk. Don't forget to check out her book, The Crazy Bee. The Author Hour continues, the best of the Author Hour, as we will talk now in just a few moments with Dean Koontz, prolific author Dean Koontz, and talk to him about his book, The Silent Corner. That's coming up in just a couple of moments right here on Monday Night Talk, heard only on 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
This weight loss segment brought to you by Signature Healthcare, providing a team approach to weight loss, including medical and surgical options. Here's Dr. Deborah Abeles, Chief of Signature Healthcare's Weight and Wellness Center in Brockton.
When it comes to medical or surgical weight loss, patients now have more options than ever before. At our practice, we're always trying to guide patients to the option that makes the most sense for them. So for some, that may mean surgery to help them lose weight, put their diabetes into remission, or reduce the number of medications that they take. However, there are also less invasive options like our 12-week doctor-supervised medical weight loss program. Patients work with our dietitian and lifestyle counselors while receiving ongoing physician consultation to make sure they are losing weight safely and effectively.
To learn more about Dr. Abeles and see if Signature Healthcare's medical and surgical weight loss approaches may be right for you, visit mysignaturecare.org/weightloss.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Monday Night Talk for our final segment, probably the best segment of the evening. Joining us is number one New York Times bestselling author Dean Koontz, and he's here to discuss his new suspense novel, The Silent Corner, which is the first in a new series, which is already optioned for television. Welcome to Monday Night Talk, Mr. Koontz.
Thanks for having me there.
So I want to ask you, you're known as probably one of the most widely read authors. You have over 500 million copies sold in 38 languages. At one point in your life, did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
Strangely enough, it goes back to when I was, at least to when I was 8 years old. And when I was 8 years old, I started writing stories on tablet paper and drawing the cover and stapling the left edge and covering the staples with tape so nobody would prick their fingers, and then tried to sell those to relatives for a nickel. So it began very early with me. I was the writer, the publisher, the agent, the bookseller, all of that in one. And I've never been 100% sure where that came from, because there were no books in our house.
Okay. Well, we recently, you know, we like having authors on from time to time, and Hank Phillippe Ryan, who was actually an investigative reporter for a local Boston area television station, now has found her groove as a mystery writer. I got to ask you, what was your career early on until you achieved enough success just to be a full-time writer?
Well, I sold my first short story when I was a senior in college, and it had won a prize in a contest that the Atlantic Monthly sponsored for college student writers, and it was very nice to get the certificate and the praise from the English department, but there was not a dollar associated with the prize. And I took the same story and sold it in those days for $50, which was much more than the now, when paperbacks back then cost 50 cents.
Right.
I thought, wow, here I get 100 paperbacks. That was not going to be enough to keep me alive, but I started selling science fiction short stories and novels, mostly paperbacks. And because I had read those as almost my exclusive genre as a child, but by the time I got to be, I think I was about 25 or something like that, I realized that this isn't what I wanted to be writing for the future. So I gave that up, and my wife made me this offer. She said, I know you want to write. You're proving you can do it, and I think you can make a living at it. But let's see. She said, I'll support you for 5 years, and if you can't make it in 5 years, you can never make it. And I tried to negotiate up to 7, but she has Sicilian blood, so she always wins those kind of negotiations. And about 5 years later, she was able to quit her job and go to work here running things like the whole financial side of everything. So it took quite a while. People think you've been a bestseller for a long time, that it was overnight, but it was not by no means overnight.
Okay. It's rumored that you read approximately 200 books a year, and you probably have a little over 40,000 books in your library. What types of books catch your interest?
Well, that's probably a little thing you've read from early on. The first couple of decades we were married, we each read about 200 books a year. Most of them were fiction at that time, but that had a lot to do with how I learned to write fiction, was reading so much of it in so many different genres. But now I read a great deal for research, especially on this new series, these Jane Hawke books, starting with The Silent Corner. There's a huge amount of stuff I needed to research in every level. And it's funny, because when I was a kid in high school and college, I hated going to the library. doing research, and I always faked it. I made fake resources and put footnotes to books and authors who didn't even exist. It's something I'm not terribly proud of, but and years passed where nobody ever caught me at it. And now I find, as a as an adult and working writing fiction, that the research is one of the things I love the most. So finally, I'm maturing.
See, today you're known. The world knows you as a marvelous storyteller. But there was a time that you actually delved into science fiction novels like Star Quest and Demon Seed, which you wrote in 73 and then rewrote in 1997. Is the creative process any different than writing suspense novels?
I'd say it's different in writing every kind of novel. When I gave up the science fiction, I bought back the rights to all books except Demon Seed. I couldn't get that back. And put them out of print forever so there'd be no confusion. And then I was writing suspense. I moved from that into writing things with somewhat of a supernatural bent, also started introducing comedy to them. And now it's sort of, right now with this series, I'm sort of flat out grab you by the throat suspense, but also is about some serious issues. And I've found over the years that as I've changed the kind of thing I write, each one requires something different of you, but in a way, nothing less. It's why I often say literary fiction is simply a different genre from mysteries or from science fiction or from suspense. They all require something considerable from you as a writer if you're going to do it well.
Okay. We're speaking with the number one New York Times bestselling author, Dean Koontz. He's here to discuss his new suspense novel, The Silent Corner. Now, in the newest book, which hit the stores on June 20th, we meet Jane Hawk, FBI agent gone rogue. If you will, share with our listeners a little background on this fascinating character.
Well, I sat down. Sometimes you know where a book, what the seed for it was, and sometimes you don't. And in this case, I didn't. I knew I wanted to write a story featuring a female FBI agent on leave or maybe gone rogue. By the end of book one, she's totally rogue. But I didn't know what it was going to be about or what it was that impelled her into this. And I thought I would write it in little moments, like smaller scenes, so that instead of introducing a character, telling you about the character, and setting up the storyline or the central conflict, that I would just follow her through a series of small scenes, letting her reveal a little bit about herself here and a little bit about herself there, and also raise more questions about her as you learn things. And I'd never got a story going that way before, and by the time I was probably, I'd say 20 pages into it, I knew I had a very uninteresting character here, and the way it evolved as those early chapters got going was I realized Jane was on the road alone. She on the road alone because her husband, a career Marine at the age of 32 and a full colonel, the youngest in the Marine Corps, killed himself. And she has never believed he killed himself. And she's looking into his suicide and discovers there are all these suicide rates has escalated in the U.S. And there's about 8,000 additional suicides a year than usual, and these are almost exclusively among people who are successful in their fields, happily married or happy in their other circumstances, and never been depressed, and that fits the profile of her husband. So she, at that point, wants to know what's going on here, and that's when she and, give a tiny plot point away in the first one, she and her five-year-old son come under threat, and Jane has to hide out her child and try to understand what's going on, and pretty soon becomes the most wanted fugitive in America. The character just, I say sometimes I've been married 50 years, and this is the second time I've fallen in love with a woman, but this one's fictional, so it's not going to lead to divorce. And Jane is just the most fascinating character I've ever gotten. I'm working on book four with her, and it's the combination of her toughness. She's as tough as it gets, but also has this enormous good heart and a tender side. And all of this together, I don't know how long I can write about Jane and be fascinated, but so far, book by book, I'm more fascinated each time I go back to her.
And you actually, one of my questions was, is it true that that Jane has become one of your favorite characters to write about? Why is that, that she is so fascinating, and what makes her different than any other of the other characters that you have written about in the past?
Well, I've written many women character leads, but in this one, I tend to let characters describe who they are. I don't sit down with character notes. I don't start with a plot outline. And if a character comes on a scene, I knew it wanted to be this woman FBI agent. I knew almost immediately she was widowed. But I let her tell me who she is. And if I can, what fascinates me is all kind of elements about her. But I know one of the things that fascinates other people, because so many in my publishing life, from my editor to my publishers here and elsewhere, they come back to her wit, and I don't mean by that necessarily her humor, although she has a very dry wit, but they mean that she is, one of them said to me, how, she is so intelligent, she figures these things out, and how did you get that? I said, well, Jane can figure something out in 1 minute to do, and you go, wow, that was cool. But I sit here for 4 days trying to figure out what that'll be. I'm unfortunately not as intelligent as Jane, but it's her intelligence, her cleverness that partly drives this. And then I've gotten a lot of feedback. My editor said, I just love the way she talks to the bad guys. Mm. And I will say, I've never seen another character, I've certainly never written one, who talks to people in the way that Jane does. And there's just something about her attitude that is just so enormously appealing. I'm getting a lot of fan mail on the book now that it's been out a week. And there's a thing repeated where people say, I wish she was real. I wish she was a friend of mine. And that's what I think makes her appeal to me. I wish I had friends who were this tough-minded, and yet this sensitive, and underlying it so sweet. And yet, she walks a very fine line. Sometimes you think she's stepping over a line here and doing something I don't approve of. But until you follow her through it and you realize, no, she never goes too far over the line. And that's another thing in an age when often characters in these roles, the police authority, are portrayed as corrupt. Jane is not corrupt. But when she's dealing with very corrupt people, she knows how to play on their level.
How much research did you have to put in to Jane Hawke in order to, develop that fine line between her, that tough exterior, but yet she has a sensitive side too?
Well, there was an enormous amount of research based on the very fact that once Jane she takes leave of absence, but when she suddenly... it's no longer a leave of absence, and she's being hunted by let's call it a conspiracy or a cabal. It's part government, part private industry, and they're trying to hide something of great importance to the future of the world. And she has to go off the grid, and that became a big research issue. And in figuring out how she goes off the grid, how she can use the internet but not be caught or tracked, how she can use a car because she has to use one with no GPS. She can't use a regular cell phone, and she can't even use a burner phone for any protracted length of time in a metropolitan area because the NSA has a way of tracking even burner phones if they're used too consecutively. It's all these things that I had to learn about, and I found out very quickly that all the people who think they're off the grid aren't off the grid at all. And these preppers we see on TV, they're nowhere near off the grid. And so when Jane had to learn to be almost invisible, and there's always somebody at her heels because there's people just as smart as she is trying to catch her. She's no superwoman. When I had to research all that, it started refining that's all sides of Jane. It had to bring her, she had to be a lot more clever than I probably would have originally written her. And as that cleverness came in, as the intelligence grew in the character, I think it sharpened both her toughness and her tenderness, because I've always felt that if you combine intelligence with common sense, you get some of the best people you know. But if you have intelligence with no common sense, there you've got a master criminal.
If I can add a little addendum to the what you just said, this is straight out of your book before part one, Rock Me. Those who are truly off the grid and cannot be tracked by any technology, yet are able to move about freely and use the internet, are said to be in the silent corner. It's straight out of your book, which is well said. That kind of captured me just thumbing through the first few pages. I go, ooh, some intrigue here, and there's some thrilling turns in the book. And of course, you have to build in kind of a cliffhanger to hook folks for the next book, which is due out early next year. What was that like to try to keep folks captivated throughout the book with different twists and turns, and then also, you know, have them stay on board for your next book coming out in January?
Well, it's one thing I try to do when I'm... There's two kinds of series. There's this kind of series in which you meet a character, and the character is always the same book by book, always simply on another case. Or in this case, for what I believe will be seven books, I don't think that's the only ones I'll write about Jane, but the first seven books will have an overriding arc. But nevertheless, each one has to stand alone. She has to achieve things at the end of the book, and even though she hasn't reached perfect safety, you have had quite a ride with her, and then that's a fair kind of series book to do in this vein. But I didn't consciously do any cliffhanger. What I felt about these was that if you love these books, you're going to love them largely because of the character. Now, they really move, I think. I wanted to make these books just speed along, and I wanted to have lots of twists and turns in them, which sort of eventuates pretty naturally from the setup. But when I got to the end, I want you to be able to have, of each volume, take a very deep breath and feel, man, she made it. But yet, there's more that's coming. And so that's sort of how I left the first one. She's achieved a lot of what you would wanted to see done. But this conspiracy is much more, it's like a hydra. And if you cut off one head, that doesn't mean there isn't another one. And so far, I'm working on book four, and I'm involved in it with the same level of excitement as the first one. So I hope that'll convey to readers. I certainly try my hardest at it.
Yeah, my understanding is that Jane has kind of helped renew you as a writer. Is that accurate?
I would say that's true, yeah. When you've been at it as long as I have, you've tried your hand at a lot of different things, publishers generally don't like that. They like you to do one book of the same kind over and over. And I've moved around to different kind of things. And so I've had my chance at trying almost anything that interested me or I felt was challenging. And when it came to this, you thought, okay, I want to do something with this, a character like this, and do something I haven't seen done before. But still in all, I've written suspense before. So when you're writing it and suddenly you know you've got your hands on something electrifyingly different, and something that just excites you, it's a wonderful thing. And it's happened to me before when I've been writing, and that makes it, especially if it happens in the first 20 or 30 pages of the manuscript and you've got 350 more to go and you're excited off the top of the charts, that is a blessing, because the book is going to be hard work. They always are hard work, but it's not going to be that kind of hard work that makes you smash your forehead into the desktop several times a day in frustration. It's going to be hard work that bears fruit every day. And so in that sense, she really has enlivened me and brought me back to the excitement you have when you're doing the early books in your career.
You are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, heard worldwide, 95.9 WATD.com, and we're privileged to be speaking with the best-selling author Dean Koontz about his newest book, The Silent Corner. Dean, how soon could we see Jane either on network television or cable? Because from, again, what I'm understanding here is this is a option for television.
Yeah, it's been optioned by Paramount TV. They actually optioned all the Jane books that there might be, and in association with Anonymous Content. And Anonymous Content has, I think, 5 shows on there recently or still on the air, and they do very classy, stylish stuff, and they seem very excited about it. So, but all of this is a slow process, so these days it does happen a little faster if they get the right showrunner on it. And so I'm very hopeful, but I haven't always had good luck with Hollywood, but given how TV is these days, that it's the place where you see most of what you want to see as compared to feature-length films, which have gotten kind of redundant one after the other, mm-hmm. the same kind of thing. TV is allowing more flexibility in storylines and more cutting-edge kind of stuff. So I'm very hopeful about it, but I've been around the track before, so I don't go to bed hooting with joy that there's going to be a TV series. But I think it's more likely than not going to be good.
Okay. I would ask you, and I would pull this from your frequently asked questions, do you have any movies that are based on your novels, or do you have any that could be in the works?
There's another TV series that seems to be moving forward. It's not filming or anything, but that's based on the novel Ashley Bell that was out about 2 years ago, and a series of novellas I wrote interconnected with the world of the novel, and that was all optioned by Universal, and I know they've been working on that. And there's a couple of things bouncing around in the feature film area, but again, I don't... I always advise young writers when they get... it's so exciting. I got my new book done, and now I'm taking a break from books because I'm writing the screenplay based on it. I always wish them great good luck, but warn them, you can write a script that everybody loves that gets greenlighted, and then after it's greenlighted, which used to mean it would almost certainly be filmed, then you will get some young, very enthusiastic, but megalomaniacal director that will be assigned to it, who will some way or other ruin the entire project before it ever gets a chance to go before the camera. And so far, when I've given that warning, there's nobody that hasn't come back and said a couple of years later, boy, I wish I'd have understood what you were telling.
Right.
So I will not be writing any more feature films or TV. I wrote and sold a number of them, but I'm not a guy that can work in a collaborative medium, I guess you would say, and that is all very collaborative. I like to have the total control, and unless you're Steven Spielberg, you don't have total control, and it's too frustrating a medium.
Well, we just got a couple more moments with you, Dean, and I want to kind of stay on the TV thing, because I'm not sure if this is accurate or not, but I believe that you're a fan of the reality show, the TV show Survivor. Is that true?
No, in fact, I've never watched it.
Okay. I thought it was something that I had seen on your website, that you were a fan of a series like that.
I'm trying to think what that might have been. What I watch with television is usually series, and I usually binge watch. I wait until it's been on, like Breaking Bad was completely finished before my wife and I started to watch it, mm-hmm. and became so hooked that one Saturday we watched 10 episodes in a row. And that I liked, and the series that sprang out of that, Better Call Saul, I think, is
yep.
one of the finest things on television. So I tend to not watch much TV, and I don't watch a whole lot of reality TV. In fact, I'm not sure I watch any. So that might be something on the website we have to go clear up.
Okay. And probably the final thing I would ask you is... tell folks, as far as if they want to find out more about things that you're working on, whether it's your website, whether it's your publisher's work website, or maybe social media, how can they follow what Dean Koontz is up to?
Well, one way is the website, which is deankoontz.com, and it's a pretty well-maintained website. It's a lot of content on it, and we put up news as there is any news to put up. And I think my publisher takes care of the Facebook. We have about 1.3 million friends on there. And if we ever get together for a picnic, we're going to need a year to get ready for it to make all that potato salad.
Well, we want to thank you for coming on, and we know that this is airing prior to your birthday, so we want to wish you an early birthday. Your birthday is coming up on the 9th, correct?
July 9th.
July 9th.
And, I stopped counting them some time ago, but I'm very happy to keep having them.
Well, we wish you a very happy birthday, and we thank you very much for coming and appearing on Monday Night Talk and talking about the book. And when the Whisper Room is ready for release, we would love to have you back on to tease folks more about Jane Hawken and what she's up to.
I would be very happy to be there. It's been you draw out your guests very well, so that is a blessing for somebody on this end of the phone.
Well, listen, you have yourself a fantastic day and evening, and we look forward to hopefully talking to you more down the road.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Our guest has been the one and only Dean Koontz, again, a gentleman who has sold, that's a fantastic number, 500 million copies in nearly 40 languages worldwide. A gentleman who has 14 novels that have risen to number one on the New York Times hardcover best-selling list. Titles including One Door Away from Heaven, Dragon Tears, The Husband, Odd Hours, What the Night Knows. Just some great books. And again, he was here to chat with us a little bit about this new book, which is a fantastic book. If you haven't, if you're somebody who loves suspense novels, you definitely want to check this one out. And again, we thank Dean, and we thank his publisher, Penguin Random House, for that fantastic interview, having a chance to speak with a gentleman who, you know, you heard the story as to how he got started. I wanted to make sure I built that in instead of just talking about the book. Had a chance to kind of get a little insight into how he got started in writing books and the deal he cut with Gerda, his wife, who he pays tribute to in the first handful of pages in the book, which is pretty cool. Well, that's going to do it for us here, as that's another Monday Night Talk in the books. Be sure to keep the radio dial set right here at 95.9 WATD. Up next is South Shore Live with Stan and the gang. So stay tuned for that. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.